Let's go to our Monday expert at 28 past two. And today our expert topic is leaky homes. Probably all know that phrase now. More than 100,000 homes in New Zealand rotting because of, well, a number of factors. Peter will talk us through all of them. The first reports began in the early 90s, although the problem had started well before then and continued to this day. How did it all happen? What failures led to the crisis and what is the cost? Well, journalist Peter Dyer has explored the issue in a new book. It's called Rotonomics, the story of New Zealand's leaky building disaster. And he's in our Wellington studio. Hi there, Peter.
Hello, Jesse. How are you?
Great, thank you. And if listeners would like to make a comment or ask a question, 2101 is the text number. So when did you get interested in this?
I guess I got interested in 2008. I had just written an article for North and South on housing, New Zealand housing, some historical, very interesting stuff from the neighborhood that we lived in Niall Wellington. And then during an exchange with the editor, Virginia Larson, soon after that, she mentioned something about leaky buildings. I said, I'd love to do something on leaky buildings. So fast forward to early 2012, I had an article printed in North and South and found myself unable to stop looking into it. It was a fascinating, complex topic, and luckily I had the support I needed to be able to look in this at the speed I needed to do it and at the depth I needed.
We, almost everyone listening will know that phrase, the leaky homes crisis or the leaky homes disaster, as you call it. And you no doubt have looked at a lot of the reporting on the issue so far. Is the overall sort of tone and content of the reporting, has it been accurate, do you think? Has it given us a good sense of what exactly has gone on?
Well, I think that one of the aspects of the overall tone, at least in the past few years, has been the use of the past tense.
Mm.
And as if it's something that happened before, you know, back in the days when we were building leaky buildings, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, without exception, everyone in the industry I've talked to says we are actually still building leaky buildings.
Really?
Now, the other aspect of that is we seem to have made some progress, but the model I use in laying out the problems as I've come to understand them is a perfect storm. A whole lot of different elements came together within a fairly short period of time, and we seem to have addressed, to some degree, some of those elements, and some of them are still outstanding. And so we've still got problems with weather tightness failure, and as we've seen in a Radio New Zealand report today, other parts of the construction industry as well. Phil Pennington's article about concrete structural failures is chilling, isn't it?
I've actually not across that. I saw it on the RNZ website today, and the basic tenor of the article, I think, is that they've had a look at a lot of buildings in New Zealand and found that the structure is not nearly as robust as you might expect it to be. If we're talking about leaky homes, a leaky home crisis, most of us probably think of a certain style of home, one built in the 90s. Is stucco the word that I'm looking for, that sort of distinctive cladding?
Yeah, that's stucco would be one of two or three different kinds of monolithic cladding. So that's the phrase often used. And it refers to a smooth kind of unblemished facade, a face, you know, unlike weatherboard or brick or anything like that. Anybody in New Zealand will recognize that style. And often in the features of design that go with it are no eaves and an attempt to look like buildings that were a long time ago designed and withstood the weather for centuries in the Mediterranean,
uh-huh,
where it's generally quite warm and dry.
So
go ahead.
Yeah, well, those sorts of things aren't being built anymore in New Zealand. So why do you say that the crisis is continuing?
Well, I didn't know those weren't being built, but I'm glad to hear that. Well,
what do I know? I don't know anything. But I'm presuming that the exact problems that those houses had, you're referring to a different sort of problem than just those ones in the 90s, right?
I believe that problem with monolithic claddings actually has been addressed to a large degree by changes in the Building Act. But
that's what someone just texted me and asked, could houses that are still being built today become leaky homes? And you are sort of suggesting that they could.
Yeah, but there's so many other elements of the leaky building's perfect storm that remain to be fully addressed. So they got a big one, I think. External moisture has been addressed to a fair degree, but there are a number of other aspects of the building code that, and what you generally need to have a weathertight building, that still are lagging. And this is, I'm just repeating what industry people tell me, without exception.
And we'll talk through the sort of the narrative of your book, but in between times, I'll sort of throw in some texts as they come to me, like Ellie would like to know, and we're sort of vaguely on topic for this question, is internal guttering a risk factor for a leaky house?
Well, it can be. You're talking about guttering behind the facade?
I suppose so.
Yeah. That was often a feature of some of those monolithic houses. And, everything really has to be quite well designed and well built from what I understand. And I want to make it clear now that I'm approaching deep water. I'm not an architect.
Yeah.
But what I have is an overview, and I can comment on things like that, but I can't give you engineering specs or anything like that.
Okay. So what are the origins of the leaky home crisis? And there might be a bit of a clue in the title of your book.
Okay. I think one of the first things that happened, and probably often at least one of the first things that started getting attention in the first articles about leaky buildings, and one of the factors that really gets the most publicity, if not the most, is untreated timber, untreated radiata. There was a change of building standards. By that I mean Standards New Zealand, a couple of changes that in 1992, 93, and 95 that gave us what in effect was a preservative without protection against decay. And that's the problem. But the problem was magnified even further when in 1995, Standards New Zealand okayed, in certain situations, the use of completely untreated timber with no preservative at all in certain structural situations in New Zealand houses. And so, but as the book explains, it seems clear that a lot of those developments that gave us leaky buildings actually preceded those decisions. For example, the serious abolition of widespread skills training in New Zealand happened both in the public sector and in the private sector. Skills training agencies such as the Ministry of Works, Electricity, Post Office, and so forth, those departments were simply abolished. They turned out hundreds and hundreds of skilled people every year at very rigorous skills training programs. Then you had the Employment Contracts Act, which essentially put paid to unions, and union apprenticeships had been giving us skilled people for almost a century.
So that's in parallel with what was part of some of the stripping away of the state that the 1984 Labor government did. Is that where you sort of see the origins at?
Well, the state agencies such as Ministry of Works were abolished in the Labor government from 1984, between 1984 and 1990. But the Employment Contracts Act, of course, was national. And that brings me to what I think is an interesting point. I've looked and looked for a way to blame labor more or national more, and I just can't find it. It seems about as evenly distributed, the responsibility, as you can get for leaky buildings in New Zealand. They both like to point fingers at each other, which is the way in New Zealand politics. But in the end, I think that historically, both parties are pretty much equally responsible.
Okay. How did anyone ever approve untreated timber as a good thing to build houses with?
I'm sorry, one more time, please.
Yeah. How did that happen, that untreated timber was approved as a building material?
Okay, I'll go to the best-known decision, which is the Standards New Zealand decision in 1995, September 1995. And it's ironic. I've gone through hundreds of pages of the reports and the conversations of that decision, and it's all focused on the dangers of borer. There's almost no mention of the dangers of rot, of decay. And ironically, when you go back, that looks to be the result of an entirely successful regime of boron-treated timber that been in place since the 1950s that had worked so well that people really stopped thinking about the dangers of decay, at least in houses. And eventually, say in the late 80s, early 90s, some people started saying, well, why do we need all this preservative? It's expensive. It's time-consuming. And we've seen lots of old houses that were never used treated timber that have borer damage, but they're still structurally sound. So the focus was on borer, and really there was hardly any, I'm unable to find any concern about rot in that whole process.
Just wasn't on their radar.
No, absolutely. It's a good way of putting it. And it looks like, to me, the reason it wasn't on the radar is because we got so used to homes that resisted rot that we just stopped thinking about it.
The Building Act of 1991 is a big part of this story. By the way, if you've just tuned in, we're talking about the leaky homes crisis as our Monday expert topic. What was the Building Act of 1991 all about?
Well, the Building Act 1991 was a radical departure from previous legislation. It actually was the first unified building control system in New Zealand. There was no unity before. Everything was down to each local authority, and building standards and could vary from one authority to another, and people were tired of that, understandably, thought that was unnecessarily time-consuming. So they came up with, you know, long story short, a unified building control system. Now, the idea with this unified building control system was that it was performance-based. Performance-based means it's not as opposed to prescriptive. Prescriptive means you put nails, you know, 20 millimeters apart, 20 centimeters, whatever, here, on this type of weatherboard, and so forth. It tells you exactly what to do and where. Whereas performance says, make it work.
Uh-huh.
That's all you have to do. And that philosophy has permeated a great deal of our culture and our government and our industry, as you know. So, but this was such a radical departure from the previous regime that it would have taken quite a lot of money and quite a lot of time for people actually to take it in and understand it. Kind of like metrication. When metrication came in, they had lots of time, lots of money getting the country used to it. But unfortunately, the Building Act came in 1991 during a recession, and a tight-fisted national government Jim Bolger and Ruth Richardson weren't in any mood to spread any funds around. And not only that, so there was no money whatever from central government to learn for the local authorities who were in charge of making this system work. No money at all for them to actually learn how to do this, to learn the philosophy, learn what it was about. I've talked to different building control officers about this, and they said, now, we didn't know what to do. What is this? What does it mean, performance-based? And not only was there no money, there was very little time. They had to learn about it essentially in about 16 months before we've had a completely performance-based building control system. So you had a lot of confusion just to start with the Building Act. And then you had other elements of the perfect storm as the building boom began. And you had a hemorrhaging of building industry skills and so on and so forth. And so it all kind of came together and gave us a disaster.
Yeah. Was it the building industry that had lobbied for that new act in 1991?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up because there was some people, I'd say people at the top, who lobbied for that. And I have to give them credit, they spent about 10 years getting together the report of the Building Industry Commission, which laid out a template for the new Building Act and explained how it was supposed to work. Unfortunately, as I said, excuse me, this didn't really filter down to the people who were actually going to make it work very well at all. The other thing about that is this was one of the first performance-based building control systems in the world. Only the UK had one, and theirs had just recently come online. So what we were doing was basically changing the old prescriptive regime for a new one based pretty much on faith. There was no research, no reports, no data indicating that this kind of building control system would be better than the other. It was pretty much, as I see it, based in faith of the free market to give us better everything for much less money.
You have a chapter titled Blame Fest. There was a bit of denial for a while, wasn't there?
I'm sorry?
Was there some denial initially around leaky buildings? People didn't want to admit there was a problem.
Oh, well, I wouldn't. You know, if I was in, especially people in higher places, if I was in charge, no, I wouldn't want to deal with that. It's ugly, it's depressing, and it's extremely complicated, extremely difficult to deal with. And really, we haven't still figured out how to deal with it. At least as far as I know, that knowledge hasn't gone up to the people who can really do something about it. Maybe they do know something about how to do about it, but it's maybe there's something in the system that prevents that from happening. But until we address those aspects of the leaky building's perfect storm thoroughly, as I've laid out in the book, I think that we're still going to have problems. We have problems, excuse me, in the construction industry all across. And this is another thing that people in the industry tell me, that it's not just leaky buildings. You've got structural problems. You've got just about anything that can have a problem. As we saw in today's report by Phil Pennington on Radio New Zealand about concrete structural failure, 1,100 out of 1,200 structures were substandard. That's shocking, isn't it?
I'm speaking to Peter Dyer, who has written a book about the leaky homes crisis. It's called Rottenomics, and he's taking us through how it happens at the moment. One of the things that makes your book different, Peter, is that you have uncovered some reports. Reports, I believe, revealed for the first time in your book.
Yes. There actually have been two reports commissioned by the then national government on leaky buildings. Actually, I take that back, leaky dwellings. It's important to keep that in mind. So there was a PricewaterhouseCoopers report in 2009 that came up with certain cost figures and certain numbers of dwellings that would fail eventually. And in 2014, I've managed to get back through some of the discussion in MBIE. Some people started wondering whether the leaky buildings thing really is that bad. The PwC report estimated $23 billion in damage and 89,000 leaky homes. And as an aside, the government changed those figures And, well, they came up with their own figures, interjected their own figures into the report, and referred to them as the consensus figures, whereas the real figures were much higher. So the figure that you see most often is $11 billion, but that figure was generated by the government after the experts who they consulted were finished. And they didn't even know about it until they saw the report when it came out in December 2009. Anyway, so another report was commissioned, and unfortunately, it was commissioned in 2014, came out in February 2015. Unfortunately for all of us, I guess, the numbers actually went the other way. According to the two women who researched and wrote it, the numbers are actually higher, in fact, much higher. This report was not about any dollar figures. There was no mandate to produce any cost figures, but they did come up with a number of leaky dwellings, and that number was over 174,000.
Wow.
So maybe almost twice as much as the original report. And I saw a need myself for some cost figures, so the best I could do was to take cost-to-dwelling ratios from the first report. In other words, how much did it cost to fix the average house, and apply that conservatively to the second report. And that's where the $47 billion estimate came from. And I know I'm running off here, but I want to make one thing clear, that it's essential that we remember that both of these reports studied only dwellings, in other words, houses. No schools, no hospitals, no government buildings, nothing else, just dwellings. So as we know, weather tightness failure affects a great many other buildings, and the eventual damage has got to be more.
That's an economic disaster for New Zealand, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. I'm sure it's the most expensive economic self-inflicted disaster in New Zealand history. I haven't heard of any other that even approaches that.
Mm. A couple of people asking why the sorts of buildings that we're talking about do so well in the Mediterranean if they don't do well here, and the answer is climate, right?
Well, I'm just guessing here, but those buildings have been around for centuries, and they developed techniques and materials that worked over that period of time, and they were probably all reasonably well built, and probably they leaked. Leaking isn't the problem. The problem is water that can't evaporate or drain. I reckon there was probably plenty of room for that. The water that got into those buildings to drain and or evaporate. But when you had the New Zealanders trying to replicate that style in different materials with a host of other problems, such as not understanding the building code, a lack of skills, and so forth, then you had a disaster in the making.
You talk about this as a current problem. You say one of the mistakes is to talk about it as a problem in the past. If we fix the treated timber and fix the monolithic cladding, what is causing problems in 2019 for houses being built?
What are the existing problems? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's right. If I was building a house tomorrow, what would I want to watch out for?
excuse me. Well,
as luck would have it, I am building a house tomorrow, but
wow.
But I'm in weatherboards and got a pretty good builder, so I think we're okay, but do carry on.
Well, that makes a lot of, I'm a consumer too. I think you're on the right track. That's, as one to another, just check your sources very carefully. Learn as much as you can, as you have time for, about the building materials and where they come from and about the building methods and about the people who are doing it, and watch them. And,
where are the weaknesses in the system, Peter?
Okay. Well, we're still having a problem with building industry skills, as you're probably aware. Time and again, when we have building booms, we have to import a whole lot of people because we don't have enough skilled people here. And that makes for problems in adapting to New Zealand. techniques, building techniques, designs, climate, et cetera, et cetera. And the building booms themselves are another problem. We have a rise and fall. We have a fairly slow level of activity, and suddenly it's all on. And what do we do?
Mm.
And this has been repeated at least three times in the last 40 years. And it's those booms that exacerbate some of the other problems. So
we've talked in terms of numbers and regulations and laws so far, but of course there are so many personal stories. Was that something that you wanted to get into the book as well?
That's right. That's absolutely right, how important that is. Yes, there are three personal stories in the book, and one is from a gentleman who was really done over by a regional council, regional local authority, and ended up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money. And another one is about what you might think of as a fairly classic case of leaky buildings. In fact, it's about a lady who I wrote the first article about for North and South, who bought a monolithic clad type condominium in Wellington and found out it was leaking, and went through a whole lot of anxiety as a result. Her happy lifestyle changed to one of stress. She got sick. She had a nervous breakdown. And she eventually, the builder fixed it. But at the time, she'd had it with home ownership. So she decided to rent from now on. I don't know if she's still renting, but she really went through the ringer. And then the other... excuse me, the other story is kind of from the other side. I mentioned how the Building Act was handed to local authorities without funding or time to properly learn about it. I talked to a lady at length who worked in the Palmerston North City Council. They had a building boom up there at the same time they were going on down here, and she talked about the stress that these building booms and the combined with a new performance-based building system and the total lack of funding and education, how that all came together and the stress that it meant for the people who were actually at the coalface trying to make it work. So, three different personal stories there from a couple of different angles.
My father, says one texter, well, first of all, I should jump in and say a few people have pointed out that the ones in the Mediterranean are made of solid stone, brick or concrete or masonry, not just wood with a sort of a cladding on it. So that's a big difference. Someone says, my father worked for Fletcher's for years and was stunned to find out his house was made with what he called box grade timber, the stuff usually used for packaging, one-time packaging.
Wow.
He was in management and he knew immediately that it was a bad idea to build houses out of it. But the problem is in the government, unqualified bureaucrats making decisions outside their pay grade to meet market demands and not the need of New Zealand citizens. That's a very political viewpoint. But perhaps you can do your best to sort of apportion blame for us, Peter. Who was at fault here? I know it wasn't just one group of people, one sector, one party, but who do we share it amongst?
You mean overall?
Yeah.
Well, I look at it myself as springing largely from the Rogernomics revolution, when the philosophy took hold at the upper levels of government and business, that we're going to turn everything over to the free market, excuse me, and the free market will give us better everything and everything will cost less. It was a faith-based decision, general decision, and it certainly was faith-based in relation to the building industry, because there was no data whatever to indicate that this was going to happen, and there was no attempt to actually provide any data. But if they'd tried, there wouldn't have been, because, as I said, there was only one performance-based building system in the world that had just gotten off the ground. But it was the idea, back to that the free market should reign supreme, and that the further we get away from that, the more bureaucracy we have, the more time everything takes, the more we have to pay attention to these burdensome rules and regulations, the poorer quality buildings have, and the more money we have to spend on them. And it actually seems to me to have actually turned out the other way, unfortunately. So this faith-based movement towards worship of the free market is largely responsible, in my mind, for this leaky buildings disaster. And that's why I called her Rottenomics, after Rogernomics.
Who has been held to account for the leaky building crisis?
Nobody in particular, but I would, the farthest I'm able to go is to say that both Labor and National share pretty much equally. That's what seems to me, that's what the record shows.
You haven't mentioned local councils much.
I'm sorry?
You haven't mentioned local councils much.
Ah, well, local councils, they were the ones who were handed the Building Act and told to make it work. With that, they didn't have any say in bringing them in, and they were given, as they say, no funding and no time to learn how to do it. So, you know, there's lack of ability at every level in every human activity, and I'm sure that there was incompetence at local authorities levels and everywhere else. But I wouldn't blame local authorities for the problems that resulted from decisions which were not made by them, but which were given to them to work with.
Well done on the book, Peter. I'm sure lots of people, if they've got any money left, will buy it with interest to find out what went wrong with their own homes. Nice to chat to you. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you, Jesse. It's been a pleasure.
Peter's book is called Rottenomics, the story of New Zealand's leaky building disaster, and he's been our Monday expert.